before I dipped into the future, far as the human eye could see, saw the vision of the world and all the wonder that would be. You are listening to Western Worlds. For another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, subtending from the Dominion Observatory an angle nearly seven times as great as the Epsilon Eridani Disk in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight's opening quote comes from the renowned poet Alfred Lord Tennyson. While he was describing the ability of the mind's eye to envision future possibilities, in an astronomical context, we typically equate observing distant objects with seeing into the past due to the time required for the light to reach our eyes. But there is another way that our observations allow us to learn about the things that have come before. We see out in the universe examples of stellar and planetary systems at all stages of development. A number of these systems show debris disks, and in some cases these disks are formed around young stars. Therefore, that allows us to imagine what our own solar system was like early on in its formation. Still other debris disks around more mature stars permit contemplation of how their history has differed from that of our own solar system, and therefore what factors might have been important in our planet's early years to lead us to what we see today. Such dipping into the past is the work of Dr. J.J. Cavalars, a senior research officer at the NRC Hertzberg Institute for Physics. In addition to his work with debris disks, Dr. Cavalars has also been part of a team that has discovered numerous irregular satellites of every one of our giant planets and a veritable swarm of minor planets. For this reason, as well as for the unfortunate situation of a terrestrial-like planet caught up in a mature debris disk, that tonight's music is The Tempest by Mike Oldfield. Such a planet would endure a truly overwhelming rock rain that might inhibit the ability of a biology to develop. Our own Parshdi Patel sat down with Dr. Cavalars at a recent conference to discuss his work.
Talking to us today. Let me start off by asking you about your research area. So you work mainly in debris disks. So what are debris disks and around what kind of stars do we actually find these kind of disks?
So debris disks are kind of like what they sound like. So debris is something that's, you know, left over. So if you're building a house, at the end of the construction, there's some lumber or whatever left over, it's the debris and you throw it away. And when the solar system formed or when a planetary system formed, the process isn't 100% efficient. You can't take all of the material, all the little bits of dust that exist in the disk around a star and turn all of it into planets. So the stuff that we call planets, the bigger objects that are kind of round on their own, well, you know, those are the planets, and then the leftover things, which are like what we would think of asteroids or comets, we call those the debris that's left over from that process. So a debris disk is basically the leftover material from that process. People studying debris disks, what we're looking at really, when we're looking at other stars, so basically, we don't know every star could have a debris disk. Without looking first, we don't know, because it's a leftover part of planet formation. And planet formation is something we don't have a really good understanding of yet. So we look for these debris disks as kind of indications of how planet formation works. But we can't see asteroids, and we can barely see planets around other stars. We certainly can't see things the size of the Earth, and we cannot see asteroids and comets. But what we can see is the collective emission of the dust that exists around a star. And with debris disks, what we really are looking at is we believe that the little asteroids that are left over, they're still running into each other. There's so many of them that there's still a good chance that two of them will collide every now and then. A couple of collisions a year produces a lot of dust, and that dust absorbs the starlight and becomes warm, and it's the thermal radiation from those that dust that we then use. So what we try to do there is we're looking at the thermal emission. So any object that has a certain temperature, it's going to give off light, and this particular wavelength of light that it gives off is associated with the temperature of that object. So we look in what's called the mid-infrared or far-infrared, anywhere from 10 micron photons out to hundreds of micron photons, looking for the signature of that extra light coming from that dust. And that's what we're doing. So people studying debris disks really are looking at that thermal emission from those stars, from the dust.
So these debris disks, what kind of sizes do we expect it to be?
Well, you know, scientists are maybe a little bit uncreative sometimes, and so what they expect to see is what they already know. And so the first people who saw debris disks, actually, they didn't even realize what they were seeing. So the first star that we looked at, that was found to have a debris disk, is actually the star Vega. And the reason it was being looked at was not for debris disk, but rather to measure it as a standard. We thought it was a star that had nothing around it. If we could measure that star, we would understand it as a star. And when the first infrared space telescopes were launched, that star's infrared radiation did not match modeling. In fact, it was too much infrared light. And then a couple other stars were seen to have the same problem. And so that infrared excess was eventually, after a lot of debate, decided that that must be from this kind of dust that I was talking about earlier. And so how big are these systems? Well, our solar system stretches out the distance from the last debris disk of the solar system, which we call the Kuiper Belt, from the sun. That's 40 times the Earth-Sun distance to get out there. So we might anticipate, okay, we would see disks out to 40 astronomical units. The Earth-Sun distance is an astronomical unit. Well, we look at some disks like Beta Pictoris, which is a star near us. Beta Pictoris has a debris disk which is much larger than that, many times bigger than this. There's so much dust around Beta Pictoris, it's completely different from our solar system. Then we look at other stars where we see debris disks that are really small. So people have been looking at the stars in the what's called the Kepler field. So the Kepler Space Telescope is looking for transits of planets in front of stars. So people will start to look at the stars that have planets, and they're looking at them trying to find dust that's close to the star, a few astronomical units. So a debris disk can be anywhere from a few astronomical units out to hundreds of astronomical units. So the scale is enormous. It just basically depends on how planets form. If we understood that completely, I could tell you where the most likely place would be, but because the understanding of planet formation is still very rough, we basically look everywhere.
Okay, so they come like in wide variety,
In a wide variety, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so would you mind walking us through the way these kinds of are detected, like the kinds of telescope used, the kind of methods that are used to say, okay, there is a disk, it's at exact this size, or, you know, the whole process.
The whole process of doing that. The thing that you need first is you need to be able to detect the infrared wavelength of light. And the trick there is that those photons that are coming from that, if they're coming from really hot dust, they can get into the atmosphere and we can observe them from the ground. As the dust gets cooler, it becomes more and more difficult to observe them from the ground. And at long wavelengths, around between 300 microns photon and 1 millimeter photons, there's only a few spots in the atmosphere that we can really actively observe. And those are very long wavelengths. We'd really like to observe it at wavelengths between 10 and 300 microns. To do that effectively, we go into space to remove the absorption from the Earth's atmosphere. So getting space telescopes has been the trick. The first ones that started doing this was the IRAS space telescope, the infrared astronomy space telescope. And IRAS detected many infrared excesses, but at wavelengths that were only associated with really hot debris disks. The next telescope that made a substantial impact was a telescope called Spitzer. And what you have to understand about telescopes is that the bigger the mirror of the telescope, the more light it collects, but also the better the resolution of the image. So the sharper the image, the smaller the structures you can see. So Spitzer was a smaller space telescope, and it could detect the infrared light, but couldn't give you a lot of spatial structure. We couldn't see a lot of spatial structure there. The Herschel Space Telescope, which is now coming to the end of its mission life, was a bigger mirror. It's the biggest astronomy mirror ever put in space. And so we're seeing a lot of detail and resolution that we couldn't see before. And now, with that telescope, we're seeing a bit of resolution, and we're seeing those infrared photons. So that's where we are exactly right now. In the very near future, most of this work will actually move back to the ground, because a lot of effort was put into building a telescope called ALMA. And ALMA is an array of infrared telescopes on top of a very dry mountaintop in Chile. And so it doesn't have the absorption problems that a lot of sites would have. And because it has a vast array of mirrors, or antennae, they're called, when you get out to really long wavelengths, they can collect a signature that we just can't get. I mean, the collecting power of the ALMA telescope is just enormous, and the resolution is going to be is fantastic. So that's what we're shifting to now. But basically what you're trying to do is two things. You're trying to observe thermal emissions. You're trying to observe something like 100, 200, 400 micron emission from a star, and you're trying to spatially resolve the structure. So you're trying to see, is it a ring of material? Is it a clumpy structure? And you're then going to make a model of how that clumpy structure might have come to be, or that ring might have come to be, how the dust would have been heated, and then see if the spectral distribution, so the wavelength distribution of the energy coming from the sources, from these debris disks, and their spatial distribution, if they match your modeling, and so we're kind of a complicated tying together of those things, yeah.
You were part of the team that actually detected the debris disks around the 61 were.
Yeah.
And so how was the process of detecting that disk, and why is it so special?
Okay, well, 61 were, the way it was detected was with, initially detected with the Spitzer Space Telescope, 70 microns wavelength, and then followed up with the Herschel Space Telescope at 70 and 100 and 160 and a number of other wavelengths. And there what we have is images that are, so we don't just have a single point saying, oh, there's excess energy coming at those wavelengths. We have actually, we can see the distribution of the light. And so with 61 Ver, what we're really seeing is a beautiful resolved image of the emission at that wavelength. So the very first image that we got from the Space Observatory, processed through a long series of different steps built by the Herschel Science team, and then you get an image basically that shows up on your computer screen. I mean, it's really a remarkable feat, right? You say, I think we should look at this star. It's a telescope in space. There's a control center. The people point the telescope over at that star. It collects some energy from the star for a while. The signal comes back to Earth. It goes through a huge team of people processing it, and finally you just see it like an image on your screen, and you can see immediately, this is not a point. There's a ring, there's some kind of structure going on here. So you can really see immediately that this is not just a star. When we measure the actual number of photons that were received by the camera in that image, we see that it was way in excess of what you'd expect for just this star. We have very good models of what stars look like. And so the excess emission we associate with the dust. Because we had observations from Spitzer and then later from Herschel, there's a time delay between those two of a few years. And the star actually is moving across the sky relative to the background stars. It's got a proper motion, we call it. So it's moving from one location to the other. And we can compare the 70-micron image taken with the Spitzer telescope to the later 70-micron image taken with the Herschel telescope. And we could see that the star and this diffuse light around the star both moved. So we know that this was not some background galaxy or something else. We know this was really associated with the star itself. This is really exciting for the planetary science community, because basically what we're getting is a detailed look at the thermal spectral emission from the star, and we can see its spatial structure. We can tie those two things together with our modeling. What we think we're seeing is that the dust is coming from a ring of material that isn't just a simple ring, you know, like it's not just a uniform ring. There seems to be that the ring probably starts off close to the star, and then the dust ring, that is, and then builds to a peak a few, about 10 astronomical units away from the star, or 5 astronomical units away from the star, and then it decays back down to a very low density far from the star. So this, we think we're starting to see basically, you know, the structure of the dust. That dust is produced by a disk of material, And so we're getting, where is that disk of material? We're getting the physics of how the dust is being transported. And there are planets in the 61-verse system that we already know about from radial velocity surveys that are done, where they measure the wiggle of the star in the sky. And so we can now tie the existence of those planets into the measured dust distribution to try to get a handle on how this whole process is working around that star.
So you would say studying these kind of debris disks can really help us understand the formation of our own solar system, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Like our solar system, if you looked at it with one of these telescopes, you would not see any dust at all. It's so devoid of collisions anymore that there's really very little dust being produced. But you look at other stars, which are quite of similar age to the solar system, and you see dust around those stars. And so the question is, well, why is there still dust being produced there and not here? And maybe that has to do with how the planets in our solar system formed versus how planets in that other system formed. We think what seems to be happening is that sometimes you form a giant planet like Jupiter, and sometimes you don't. And if the planetary system doesn't form a big giant planet, it seems, the dust stays around, which means that there's lots of debris that lasts for a very long time. Now, if you think about a bit of evolution of the Earth's life, this actually comes back to that, because the life on the Earth is stable because we don't get hit by a giant rock every now and then. I mean, we get hit every 200 million years by a giant impactor. 200 million years is a very long time period for the biology, and so there's lots of evolutionary effects that can happen in 200 million years, or in 60 million years. So our Earth is protected. It's not having these impacts. Whereas in these other systems where we see all this dust, there must be lots of debris, and so there's probably lots of impacts happening on any rocky planets that might exist. And so the chances of life evolving on those kinds of systems is probably much lower. So we're starting to see that the formation of Jupiter, a giant planet, that somehow clears away the debris, basically cleans up the solar system, seems to be an important part of where you would look in the universe for stars that might have planets that harbor life. You can't just look for Earth planets, because they'll probably be a huge debris population, unless they also have some Jupiter-like planet around that star. So we're putting the pieces of the puzzle together of how the different systems evolve, and what's important and what's not.
From the whole data that you collected, other than the 61, where you were able to find an evidence that the detectable debris disks around the nearby stars is actually correlated with the presence of the low-mass planets that are detectable currently with the radial velocity surveys. Would you like to elaborate more on that?
Yeah, that's one of the really exciting things that seems to be coming out of the survey. So the project itself that we're discussing is called Debris. And in Debris, what we've done is we've observed many stars, about 400 of them, looking for debris disks. And we're trying to get basically a really good impression of where there are debris disks and where there aren't. And the really fascinating correlation that we're finding in the solar-type star group is that for solar-type stars, if they have a debris disk, they probably don't have a massive planet. And so that's where we see, I think there's 8 or 10 stars, it's even more than that now, we'll do 11, that have massive planets, and we have no detection of a debris disk. And then we have about 6 or 7 stars where there are low-mass planets, and we do have detections of debris disks. So it's pretty strong evidence that these debris disks really are associated with the lack of a high-mass planet. High-mass planets are easier to detect than low-mass ones, so we know those ones where we see disks and we have low-mass planets. We know that if there was a high-mass planet, it would have been detected and wasn't. So we know that this correlation is pretty strong. The next step there is to say, well, what are the implications? And so the implications for planet formation basically are this idea, well, there's this clearing process that the giant planets must participate in.
So what more can we expect in future from such kind of surveys? What kind of future are we looking in terms of understanding the formation of planets?
Yeah, so for the surveys themselves, for doing this debris-type work, we're going to be looking at other wavelengths now. Basically, with this ALMA telescope in Chile, is going to contribute a great deal to wavelength coverage and resolution. We're also going to be using a telescope in Hawaii called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, which is in the last years of its life. James Clerk Maxwell has basically been kept going because a new infrared camera that works at around 800 microns and 450 microns has just recently arrived at the telescope, and it's giving us another point in the energy distribution curve for these things. And so having a better distribution of the energy measurement will give us a ability to constrain the models more fully. And so those new observations are coming, and that's really what's going to make the next step happen.
So I would again like to thank you for sitting down with us today, talking about the debris disks.
It was a pleasure to be here.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Dr. Cavalar, and he was talking about the debris disks, which has a very important correlation with the formation of planets. And Dave, you have been studying formation of planets in depth. Would you like to describe a bit about how exciting this area is?
Yeah, debris disks are extremely exciting. They can tell us an awful lot about planets, and they're one of the few elements of observational planetary astronomy that we can actually get, like, pictures of these things. So, and we actually do have images. So one of the famous images of the first direct detected planet, Fomalhaut, Fomalhaut B, that comes complete with an image where it looks like a giant red eye. It's like the red eye of Sauron or something. And the red all around the central star is the debris disk, is all this dust emitting at infrared wavelengths. And using that information, using pictures of the debris disk, we managed to figure out an awful lot about the planet. So, yeah, it's an extremely informative field that gives us an awful lot of information about systems and planets and formation processes and evolution processes.
There's a lot we don't know about how planets form, even though we happen to have eight of them very close by. You know, there's these models that have gotten discussed, and some are more prevalent than others, like the Nice model, for example. But we still don't really know really how it works, right? Because in these models, there's a lot of variables that can kind of be twisted and turned into figuring out really what, if you want it to be a certain way, you can make it that way. So it's interesting so that we can now observe these disks around other stars, and we can start really seeing pictures in an evolutionary sequence, really, for younger stars and older stars, and really what it would look like from very young solar systems out to older ones.
And even in our own solar system, as Dr. Cavalar has mentioned, the Kuiper Belt would be the closest analogy, and the asteroid belt as well, although neither of those would be anywhere near as bright as the debris disks from anywhere else that we can observe. But nonetheless, those are the analogy in our solar system. And when it comes to trying to understand how our solar system formed, the asteroid belt and the Kuiper belt form or give us a great deal of the constraints that we can use to try and figure out what happened. So because there's so much material and it has inner and outer edges, it has density distributions, it's got different types of asteroids flying around in the asteroid belt, so it can be extremely useful.
Right, all those things can constrain what would happen in our solar system in order to make those populations where they are, how thick it is, and the distribution of the objects. And so studying those small objects in our solar system is actually very important, even though they're, you know, a lot of people might not think they're very cool because they're tiny and they're maybe not so interesting as, say, Jupiter or Saturn, but they are very helpful.
And they give us some of the best details that we have.
It is also very interesting to see how studying these debris disks and the exoplanetary systems that we are actually, you know, able to detect and image, we can actually point out how our system is very different than what we think the other systems would be, and comparing not only understanding how the formation of our solar system happened, but the formation of other solar systems, which are probably not like ours. So having a unified theory for all different kinds of models is very important, and these kinds of, you know, studying these kind of debris disks can really help us pinpoint one theory that can actually, you know, help us understand the formation of planetary systems.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's all well and good for us to know how our solar system formed, but
Which we don't,
right? But, you know, to get a certain number of data points, more and more data points, is very important because, like you said, you can find that unifying theory that explains everything or all the formation scenarios, not just our own.
And debris disks can be found in young systems. They can be found in relatively old systems. They can be found with planets, with no planets. The case of Fomalhaut B, I think that is a giant planet. It's still very young, so it's actually hot, which is why it's visible. And one of the ways that we can learn the most about it is because it's carving out an inner hole in its debris disk, and it's causing, I think, a bit of an inclination on the disk as well. So this tells us an awful lot about how the planet orbits and how it's interacting with the disk, and that's actually pretty much how we nail down what its orbit is.
Yeah, like it's doing the clearing thing that that Dr. Cavallaro has mentioned in the interview, where you have these large Jupiter-sized or larger planets, they're going to be clearing the debris disk out. And interesting how he had that correlation, where he talked about, you know, if we see a debris disk, there tends not to be large objects. And then if we don't see it, there tends to be
smaller
objects.
There is some theory supporting the idea that terrestrial planets help produce debris disks. Because let's say you have a great deal of large asteroids, you still need them to collide and break each other up to produce this micron-sized dust. And it's that dust that we observe. And so a small planet, can go around and cause these perturbations and shatter up the asteroids and create all this dust. There is some theory to the effect that perhaps when we see debris disks, we're actually looking at planets with maybe terrestrial-sized objects, possibly still in the young phases. So this could definitely be telling us about where to look for small terrestrial world.
It is also very interesting how the correlation actually pinpoints to how important giant planets are in our, even in our outer, like, solar system, because our existence, we should thank to Jupiter and Saturn, because now we are being protected by these smaller, you know, objects in the solar system, as he said, like, not hitting us every few years, you know?
Right.
So it's very interesting that these kinds of studies lead to not only understanding of our solar system, but also the understanding of why we are here.
Yeah, that's very true. And I actually get that question a lot when I go to schools, is what would happen if Jupiter blew up or if Saturn blew up? Well, I have bad news for you. You know, it wouldn't just be a cool explosion in the sky. It would be, you know, we would get bombarded by, you know, comets coming in from the outer solar system. Who knows what would happen to the Trojan asteroid population if Jupiter wasn't there. So there's all sorts of things to consider. It's not just a cool planet to look at. It actually has a purpose for, in our sense.
Even for the asteroids, like asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter, and Jupiter obviously has a lot of effects on it. And if Jupiter did not exist, we'd probably be bombarded by those.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those asteroids are in resonances with Jupiter,
Jupiter,
right?
Determines the structure of the asteroid belt. And during the formation of the solar system or any other planetary system, all those rocks and small objects, they are originally there. And then how they get scooped up and built up into larger and larger things determines the nature of the planets that will eventually arise. So whether you're going to have a great deal of objects left over in a big debris disk or just a few in an asteroid belt, that tells you the history of and possibly what will happen for various systems of how you build planets, and what gets left over, and what gets built up, and how they interact.
Debris disks are really interesting to study, and not only, you know, in the context of understanding the protoplanet system, but also the evolution of the star and the material around it and how it affects the star itself. And these kinds of disks are found around, you know, massive stars, small, young stars. So there's a lot of variation on how what happens to this disk also depends on what kind of star it is around. So it has not only, you know, importance in studying the solar system or exoplanetary systems, but also understanding the star in itself as well.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Parshati Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Parshati Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Parshati Patel, John Moores, and Michael Forrester. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.